Genesis chapter 47. Then Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers, their flocks, their herds, and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan, and indeed they are in the land of Goshen." And he took five men from among his brothers, not all of them, just five of them, and presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" And they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to dwell in the land, because your servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." Then Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and your brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any competent men among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock." Then Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of my years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." So Jacob left Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. That was just another name for Goshen. Then Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with bread according to the number in their families. Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, for the grain which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed." They ran out of money. Then Joseph said, "Give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock, if the money is gone." So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses and the flocks, the cattle of the herds, and for the donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. When that year had ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, "We will not hide from my lord that our money is gone, my lord. Also has our herds of livestock. There is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our own bodies and our own land. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we will buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants to Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate." Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every man of the Egyptians sold his field because of the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had rations allotted to them by Pharaoh, and they ate their rations which Pharaoh had gave them. Therefore they did not sell their lands. Then Joseph said to the people, "Indeed, I brought you and your land this day for Pharaoh. Look, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the harvest that you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh, four-fifths shall be your own, as seed for your field and for your food, for those of your household, and as food for your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day, that Pharaoh should have one-fifth, except for the land of the priests only, which did not become Pharaoh's. So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Now, if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. You shall bury me out of Egypt and bury me in the burial place." And he said, "I will do as you've said." Then he said, "Swear to me." And he swore to him. So Israel bowed himself on the head of the bed. Well, it's a big chapter. We've got a lot to cover. Slightly shorter next week, but last week we finished our teaching in chapter 46 by learning about Joseph's wise understanding of Egyptian culture and politics. He knew where he wanted his family to settle, and he knew how not only to obtain the best of the land, but how to be culturally sensitive. And we discovered that shrewdness is not alien to holiness. Joseph knew exactly when to speak and when not to speak. Joseph had instructed his father and brothers to declare their occupation as shepherds when asked by Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And so now we enter into chapter 47 and discover why Joseph gave his father and brothers all this advice. Well, I've never had afternoon tea with Queen Elizabeth in Buckingham Palace in London, England. But during the early part of my life, up to the age of about 16 when I left home, my mother prepared me for the possibility of that event. In England, in the days from Queen Victoria, table manners and how to behave with wealthy and rich important people like kings and queens was very important. And this culture, this etiquette carried over into my mother's era. And my mother was brought up in a wealthy home with servants, and they were very strict, and they had to behave in the correct way with table manners, a kind of Victorian etiquette. And I remember once, back in my distant past, that my mother told me off for walking hand in hand with one of my first girlfriends at the age of 14. Now, I wasn't told off for having a girlfriend so young. I was told off for walking on the wrong side of the pavement. My mother told me that I should always walk on the outside of the pavement in case a passing car splashed up some water and I got wet and my girlfriend didn't. That was Victorian etiquette going back to the days of stagecoaches and different things. So, and the reason that I'm telling you about all this etiquette is that I was taught from a very early age that there's a correct way to behave at the table and a correct way to behave in the presence of a king and queen. Now, I knew exactly what to do and say at the table if Queen Elizabeth asked me for afternoon tea. Unfortunately, she hasn't asked me yet, but if she's listening on the internet, I'm still available and I can remember the manners. Now, in the same way as Joseph knew exactly what to do in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, he had been preparing this interview and all these manners for some time. These ragtag shepherds from Canaan didn't know how to behave in front of a king, and Joseph was preparing them what to say and what to do. And the first thing that Joseph told Pharaoh was that his family had arrived in Egypt, and they were waiting there in the land of Goshen. In other words, they hadn't claimed the land, they'd like to have it, but they were just waiting outside Egypt for instructions. Now, if you have a map, Goshen was an area on the eastern part of the River Nile Delta. It was far enough away from the main city where Pharaoh lived, and you had to cross two rivers of this delta to get there. Naturally, it was a very good agricultural area, drawing water and irrigation from the Nile. And Joseph only presented five of his brothers to Pharaoh. Perhaps some of them were a bit rough looking, but anyway, he presented the five best behaved brothers. And Pharaoh, first of all, asked about the brothers' occupation, and this is important. And they replied that they were all shepherds. They also made it clear that being a shepherd was the family trade. They'd always been shepherds, that's what they did. Now, last week, we learnt that shepherds were an abomination to the Egyptians. Okay? So therefore, it would have been impossible to place the family anywhere near any Egyptian settlement. The brothers were perhaps a little bit forward in suggesting that they might live in Goshen. Nevertheless, Pharaoh spoke to Joseph and gave permission for his father and his brothers and their family to live in the land of Goshen, totally separate from the Egyptians. That fitted in with the culture of that time. In addition to this wonderful provision of the land, Pharaoh asked if there were any competent men among the brothers who would be appointed as chief herdsmen over Pharaoh's livestock. Joseph had such a good reputation for wisdom and hard work that Pharaoh didn't want to miss out on an opportunity to have his cattle managed well. Now, after this very successful audience with the king, Joseph introduced his father to Pharaoh, and we're told that the first thing that Jacob did was to bless Pharaoh. Jacob's words of blessing are not recorded here, but the normal custom of this time would be to wish the king a long life. And Pharaoh then inquired about Jacob's age. Through the study of Egyptian literature, historians have concluded that old age and death normally happened to people when they're about 110 years old. So that was the average age. Now, Pharaoh would have been surprised to discover that Jacob was 130 years old. And Jacob replied to Pharaoh with an honest answer about his life and family history in verse 10. It wasn't a good life, and he was honest about it. We're told that Jacob blessed Pharaoh again and then left his presence. And we're told that what he said, well, we're not told what he said, but it was clearly something very positive. Jacob's blessing of Pharaoh was definitely in line with what God had promised to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. This is what God promised to Abraham. Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3, it says, "Now the Lord had said to Abraham, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Now, there's no doubt that Pharaoh had abundantly blessed Joseph. Okay? That we know the story. And God was now blessing Pharaoh and would honor the blessing said by Jacob. So finally, in verses 11 to 12, we're told that Joseph provided food for his father and brothers and all the family. So that came out the government purse of everything that Joseph had gathered over this 7 years of plenty. Now for a little application here. There's one question that often arises today and has for many years concerning Israel and the Jewish nation. And the question is this: does God still bless people today if they support the nation of Israel and God's chosen people? That's a very big question, because here it is in the Bible, but does it still apply today? The other side of that question is, does God still bless the world today through Jewish people? Okay, so we have a promise from God to Abraham, and it's a promise that's never been rescinded, that God will bless those who bless Israel and curse those who curse, and through the Jewish nation, the world is going to be blessed. Okay? On the second question, I have absolutely no doubt that Israel is a blessing to the world in many ways. The first important spiritual blessing is obviously Jesus Christ. That is God's Son. And he is a Jew. He's in heaven today. He's a Jew. He's coming back one day as a Jew. So we are blessed through the Jewish people because we have a Savior, a Messianic Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. And we can never take that identity away from Jesus Christ. He will always be a Jew. The second important thing today is the way in which God is blessing Jewish people both in the land of Israel and in other places throughout the world where they live. Now, let's just give you a little bit of an idea here, because we don't get this in the news. We only get negative things about Israel and the Jewish people. Number one, Israel has the world's most advanced an efficient disaster relief program than any country in the world. So they're a little country, and yet they have the best. They've won prizes for the many times that they have supplied emergency relief to various countries in the world where disasters have struck. So if the disaster happens in the world and people call for Israel, they're there before anybody else and they're efficient. But the Haiti earthquake is the most widely known, and there are many, many more where they've won awards. That's the first thing. That's really important. They are a country that is compassionate upon other people, okay, upon poor and everything else. Secondly, Israel is the most innovative country in the world as far as technology and new products are concerned. Now, to give you some idea here, I could spend all day listing the products, but to give you some idea, we have data concerning patents of new products. Now, when you invent a new product, you can protect the design by registering it to prevent others from copying your design, okay? There's a design now that has been registered about a car engine that is different from all of our car engines that we've ever used since Ford started. So watch this space. It's in America at the moment, secretly. Anyway, to prove my point, between 1980 and the year 2000, here is a table of patents registered for new inventions. In the United States of America, 77 patents were recorded for worldwide coverage for new products. Okay? In the whole of the United States, 77 were recorded. In the whole of the Middle East, that's all the Middle East countries, 177 patents were recorded. So there were 177 inventions for that period from 1980 to 2000, that 20 years. In Israel, during the same period, there were 7,652 patents recorded to new products that are in the market in the world today. So 7,475 more inventions in this tiny land of Israel compared with the whole world. So that is just absolutely amazing. And we can't say that God is not blessing the world through the Jewish people today. Now, to answer the first question, which is perhaps a little harder to answer, are the people and nations still blessed today by God if they support His chosen people, the nation of Israel? So, Israel is not flavor of the month around the world, but is God going to bless nations today that support Israel? Well, I can say on a personal note, that the people I know who support Israel in a personal way, both in prayer and practical ways, actually testify to being a very blessed group of people. So I never challenge personal testimonies and must agree with their testimony. People profess to being blessed by God when they support the nation of Israel. What I can say is that if you ever get the opportunity to go to Israel, you are supporting the land through tourism. Tourism is a big thing in Israel and that trip. And I can assure you that you will be enriched and spiritually blessed when you travel to that land and you see the places where Jesus ministered to. So if you ever get the opportunity to support a Jewish person in a practical or spiritual way, I know that God is going to definitely repay you for your kindness. And that I am 100% sure. So I guess from my point of view, both theologically from the Bible and practically from my personal experience, God's promise still holds true today for those individuals who support Israel and the Jewish people. Now, as far as nations are concerned, historically, I'm talking about real history, the United Kingdom and the United States of America have been the biggest supporters of Israel in the past. It was the United Kingdom that pushed to get their own land and for the Balfour Treaty and all these other things. And the last sort of 50 years plus, the United States have always supported Israel. So in the past history, those two nations have been truly blessed by God. However, today the younger generation are not so supportive of these two countries. This is mainly due to a shift on the part of Christians, and they believe about the second coming, and a decline in the Christian population in these two particular countries. Now, I haven't got time to go into a theological debate today, but I do know that the Bible teaches that in the last days, in the end times, the whole world will be against Israel, okay, and then Jesus will return. So God will judge the nations of the whole world for their opposition to Israel. So watch this space, because we're getting very close, these earthquakes, everything is happening. So the blessing and the cursing still applies today to the Jewish people and the land of Israel. Very important, because when we come to the second coming, you will be pressurized in your culture, wherever you live in the world, to oppose the land of Israel. But that's not where the blessing is, because eventually when Jesus comes back, all these nations that have opposed Israel, those are the ones that are going to be cursed. So, very important to see the history of Israel coming out of the blessing of Joseph and Pharaoh and the development of this nation. Okay, and we're going to be following it through. Matthew 24, verses 79 says, "For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilence, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all the nations for my sake." So in the second coming, as we get closer, all the nations will be ganging up against Israel. But Israel doesn't have to worry, because God's in charge. And then Zechariah, this is interesting, Zechariah. See, all these prophecies in the Old Testament, some of them haven't come true yet because they haven't been fulfilled, but all the other ones have, so we can have confidence that this will happen. Zechariah chapter 14, 12 to 18. "And this shall be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem." So a plague is coming in the future for those people who will fight against Jerusalem. "Their flesh shall dissolve while they stand on their feet." That's incredible, isn't it? It's like coming out of a movie. "Their eyes shall dissolve in their sockets, and their tongues shall dissolve in their mouths." That's a horrible thing, isn't it? "It shall come to pass in that day that a great panic from the Lord will be among them. Everyone will seize the hand of his neighbor and raise his hand against his neighbor's hand. Judah also will fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be gathered together. Gold, silver, and apparel in great abundance. Such also shall be the plague on the horse and the mule, on the camel and the donkey, and on all the cattle that will be in those camps. So shall this plague be. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them will be no rain." Okay? Cursing. "If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of the Tabernacles." Now, that hasn't happened yet, but it's definitely a cursing on the nation. So, the blessing and the cursing in Genesis is still alive today. There's no doubt about it that the Bible teaches that Israel and the Jewish nation are part of God's blessing during the second coming of Jesus. Therefore, any support for this nation will no doubt be a blessing to God. Historically, Pharaoh was abundantly blessed for his support of Joseph and the start of the development of the Jewish nation. So we can see the history, and in the future, history will be fulfilled because it's his story. So that's the first thing. The second thing we have is Joseph dealing with the famine in Egypt. That's verses 13 to 26. We have 13 verses that deal with Joseph's management of the famine in Egypt. And in verse 13, we're told that the famine of the land was very severe and nobody had any bread. Now, up to this point, people would come with money to buy grain from Joseph, which he gathered and put into large barns during the 7 years of plenty. Now, when the people's money ran out, Joseph accepted their livestock instead of their money. After this, another year went by, and the people returned to try and get some more grain, but they no longer had any money. Another year went by, all the people returned to try and get some more grain, but they no longer had any more money or livestock. Then Joseph demanded their land as payment for grain. This made all the people of Egypt totally dependent upon Pharaoh. All of the people became servants of Pharaoh, except for the pagan priests who were supplied special rations by Pharaoh, and they didn't need to sell their land. So verse 23 and 24, it appears that the famine was coming to an end. Joseph gave the people of Egypt seed to sow their land, so obviously famine was coming to the end, and the land was now owned by Pharaoh's house. So they were kind of like tenant farmers. So this kind of wealthy farming community had lost everything, and they were kind of tenant farmers. Now Joseph told the people that they had to give one-fifth of the harvest to Pharaoh, and then they could keep four-fifths for their own household. So not only were they tenant farmers, but they had to give a fifth to Pharaoh. And the people responded positively to all Joseph's demands, agreeing to be servants to Pharaoh. And finally, we're told in verse 26 that Joseph made it an official law in Egypt that one-fifth of all the harvest of the land would go to Pharaoh. Now, before we come to any personal application, you might be thinking that Joseph was a little bit hard on the people of Israel, the people of Egypt, and the surrounding nations. The people were starving, and they had little choice but to agree to Joseph's terms. Why couldn't Joseph have been a little bit more compassionate upon the people? Why did he arrange everything, ultimately, for the blessing of Pharaoh? Well, the first thing we need to say is that Joseph was in a unique situation that was pre-planned by God. So he was working out God's plan. And if we had to manage a situation to feed the world at that time, how would we do it? It would be quite difficult. So it wasn't easy for Joseph to deal with this 7 years of famine. The second thing we need to appreciate is that Joseph was in Egypt dealing with the culture of Egypt of that day. Totally different culture to the Jewish culture and the culture that we live in today. Now, he was not following the rules and regulations of the culture of the Hebrew people. In the Bible, we haven't got to Leviticus and God's laws. Therefore, Joseph can't be judged for not obeying the Jewish law. What we need to understand is the compassion that Joseph had upon the Egyptians concerning contribution to Pharaoh from the harvest of their land. Now, in the world at that time, it was normal to give 40% of your harvest to the king. So historically, if you look up all your history books, at that time that this was happening, 40% was the tax upon your harvest that you had to give to the king. Therefore, for Joseph to levy a 20% tax, it would have been considered quite low. This is perhaps why Joseph made it a law at the time, in order to keep this position favorable to the people. Some countries at that time even taxed people 60% of their harvest. So although Joseph was a good manager for Pharaoh, he wasn't uncompassionate. So don't think that Joseph was a hard character. He was trying to be compassionate to the people. And the final thing I need to say here is that Joseph was managing the situation in order to fulfill the promises of God made to his grandfather Abraham. God was honoring his promise, and through Joseph, Pharaoh was abundantly blessed, okay, in order to bless God's people. The other thing to think about is the blessing of God's people in Goshen. The food, the cattle, and everything needed to establish the nation of God's people initially came from the government purse through Pharaoh. And it wouldn't have come through the Egyptian people who despised the shepherds. So there had to be a pot of gold somewhere to start this new nation. And this could only be done by Joseph's good management of the famine. So what about application? Well, the application for us is really a repeat of what I said last week about God honoring his promises in the Bible. God will honor his promises in the Bible to us personally, but we need to be sure that we meet the conditions and understand with sincere heart how those promises apply to us. So if you weren't here last week, get a copy of last week's message, which is available on the internet, and you'll see how you can practically apply the promises of God to your own life. However, the most important promise to us personally relates to the promise of our own salvation. John 3:16 says, these are the words of Jesus, God's Son, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life." That is a promise in the Bible that applies to all of us. 1 John chapter 1, verse 5 says, "This is the message we have heard from Jesus, and now declare to you that God is light, and there is no darkness in him at all." And 1 John chapter 2, verse 6 says, "Those who say they live in God should live their lives as Jesus did." So there's some wonderful promises from God. Then we come finally to Joseph's vow to Jacob. That is verses 27 to 31. And in verses 27 to 31, we're taught about a promise that Joseph made to Jacob. Jacob was getting near to his death, and he asked his son Joseph to promise that his bones would not be buried in Egypt. He requested upon his death that his bones would be carried out of Egypt and placed in the family burial grave. We need to go back to Genesis chapter 23 to discover where this burial plot was. In Genesis 23, verses 1 to 9, it says, "When Sarah was 127 years old, she died at Kiriath Arba, now called Hebron, in the land of Canaan. There Abraham mourned and wept for her. Then leaving her body, he said to the Hittite elders, 'Here I am, a stranger and a foreigner among you. Please sell me a piece of land so I can give my wife a proper burial.' The Hittites replied to Abraham, 'Listen, my lord, you are an honored prince among us. Choose the finest of our tombs and bury her there. No one else will refuse to help you in this way.' Then Abraham bowed low before the Hittites and said, 'Since you are willing to help me in this way, be so kind as to ask Ephron, son of Zohar, let me buy this cave at Machpel down at the end of this field. I will pay the full price in the presence of witnesses, so I'll have a permanent burial place for my family.'" So he had purchased this place with a permanent burial site in this cave. And then in Genesis chapter 23, verses 17 to 20, "So Abraham bought the plot of land belonging to Ephron at Malpeh near Mamre. This included the field itself, the cave that was in it, and all the surrounding trees. It was transferred to Abraham and his permanent possession in the presence of the Hittite elders at the city gate." So it was all done properly. "Then Abraham buried his wife Sarah there in Canaan, in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre, also called Hebron. So the field and the cave were transferred from the Hittites to Abraham for use as a permanent burial place." So this cave at Machpelah was the family burial site for Abraham and his family. It's still there today. You can find this old cave situated in the old city of Hebron in the West Bank under Muslim control. People have been able to go there for archaeological work only, but not everyone can go there. So even though Joseph agreed to do this for his father in verse 30, that was not enough for Jacob. And in verse 31, Jacob made his son swear an oath about this promise. The first question you might ask is, why did Jacob ask Joseph to promise a second time, this time under oath, that he would carry his bones back to Canaan and put them in this cave? And the simple answer is that if you made an oath before God about anything, then this directly placed you under God's wrath and punishment if you failed to obey your promise. So Jacob knew that if Joseph made a vow, he would definitely honor his oath before God. So this was guaranteed that his bones would go into the family burial. And the second question comes to mind is, why was Jacob so concerned that his bones be brought back and placed in the family burial cave? Well, Jacob knew that when he died, he would go to heaven to be with his forefathers. So why bother about your bones? Why the insistence that he took them back and put them in the cave? Well, the reason for this demand was that the burying of his bones in Canaan was a declaration of his faith in the promise of the land to Abraham and his seed forever. Okay? It wasn't about his bones, it was about believing in the promises of God. And in Genesis chapter 15, verses 1 to 21, it says, "Sometime later, the Lord spoke to Abraham in a vision and said to him, 'Do not be afraid, Abraham, for I will protect you, and your reward will be great.' But Abraham replied, 'O sovereign Lord, what good are all your blessings when I don't even have a son? Since you've given me no children, Eliezer of Damascus, a servant in my household, will inherit all my wealth. You've given me no descendant of my own, so one of my servants will be heir.' Then the Lord said to him, 'No, your servant will not be heir, for you will have a son of your own who will be your heir.' Then the Lord took Abram outside and said to him, 'Look up into the sky and count the stars if you can, how many descendants you will have.' And Abraham believed the Lord, and it was counted to him as righteousness because of his faith. Then the Lord told him, 'I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land as your possession. Here it comes.' But Abraham replied, 'O sovereign Lord, how can I be sure that I will possess it?' The Lord told to him, 'Bring me a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old female goat, and a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon.' So Abraham presented all these to him and killed them. Then he cut each animal down the middle. Now this is the way they did covenants in those days, and laid the halves side by side. So he cut all these animals and laid them down, and he did not, however, cut the birds in half. Some vultures swooped down to eat the carcasses, but Abraham chased them away. As the sun was going down, Abraham fell into a deep sleep, and a terrifying darkness came down over him. Then the Lord said to Abraham, 'You can be sure that your descendants will be strangers in a foreign land, where they will be oppressed as slaves for 400 years. So, obviously, this prediction is coming up. But I will punish the nation that enslaves them, and in the end, they will come away with great wealth. As for you, you will die in peace and be buried at a ripe old age. After 4 generations, your descendants will return here to this land, for the sins of the Amorites do not yet warrant their destruction.'" Now, this is important. After the sun went down and darkness fell, Abraham saw a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch pass between the halves of the carcasses. Okay? So normally in those days, if you made a covenant, you walked through these cut animals saying, basically, if I break this covenant, you can cut me in half like these animals. Okay? There's always 2 people involved in this covenant. So it says, "And the sun went down and darkness fell. Abraham saw a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch pass between the halves of the carcasses." This is God himself. So the Lord made a covenant with Abraham that day and said, "I have given this land to your descendants all the way from the border of Egypt to the great Euphrates River. The land now occupied by the Kenites, Kenzites, Kadamites, Hittites, Perizzites, Raphites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites." So Jacob had faith in the promises of God. So that's what it's all about. And by God walking through these cut-up animals, we're showing that it was God's responsibility to fulfill the covenant. That's very important. It's all about God, not about us. So what's the application, finally, as we finish? What application can we make from this little section, verses 27 to 31? Well, one of the issues here is that the writer wants us to notice that the making of a vow towards God is a serious thing. And we need to honor that vow or promise that we make before God. Now, in the ancient world, putting your hand under somebody's thigh and making a promise was a very serious thing. It was actually meant to point to a man's private part. That was what it's all about. In the case of God's chosen people, it was pointing to the sign of the covenant. This was circumcision. So this promise made by Joseph to Jacob was a commitment connected to the covenant, a very serious vow. So the application that we have here is about making promises to God to do something for him. So I'd like to ask you a question this morning. Have you ever made a promise to God to do something for him? I remember once in my life looking back saying, asking God to do something for me, an absolute miracle, and then I promised to do something for him. And God has made me honor that promise, and that was a serious thing. But have you ever promised to do anything for God? Think about that. Just for a moment, think, have I ever made a promise to God about anything in my life? If you have made a promise to God specifically to do something for him and you haven't done it, then perhaps today you should think about putting that matter right starting today, because God hasn't forgotten the promise you've made. However, if we were counseled correctly when we first became Christians, we probably promised to serve Jesus as our Savior and Lord, or our new manager or director of our lives. The question is, how are you doing in your service to Jesus? You promised to follow him, but are you actually following him? If you are, that's great. But if you're not, consider a change of mind. And remember that God holds us and me accountable for the promises that we make to him. God makes some wonderful promises to us, and he always keeps them. Therefore, we should be serious about the promises that we make to God. Sometimes we promise to do things for God, and then he helps us, and we don't follow through in those promises. So the challenge today, if you take away one thing, is to take away the fact that God wants you to honor your promises to him. Let's pray.